When we were last together, we were talking about the besiegement and capture of the city of Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. This siege began in 725 BC. Shalmaneser V, who'd recently become the king of Assyria, began the siege, and it was finished by 723 BC. And many of the Israelis that survived the Assyrian invasion were deported into northern Assyria. What happened next is that Shalmaneser V was replaced in 722 by Sargon II. Now, there is debate as to exactly how this happened. Was there a natural death involved? Was there some sort of coup? Some people think that Sargon II was at least somehow related to Shalmaneser, but maybe not clearly. I don't think any of that ultimately matters, because we're more interested in what happened to the people of Israel. So those that were deported in 723, probably also in 722, ended up going into exile because of their sin. And they will not be back to the Promised Land. It will be many, many generations later that God will allow some of their descendants to come back to the Promised Land. But the country of northern Israel was emptied of its population for a few years before Sargon II began repopulating those cities with other peoples that he wished to move around. The Assyrians had adopted this way of controlling populations by moving them far from their home territory. And so we're going to pick up that part of the story next. 2 Kings 17:24, which I think probably happens 722, 721, maybe 720, somewhere in that range. The king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, and interestingly enough, Sargon II is connected with the region of Babylon. Kuta, Avava, Hamat, and Sepharvaim. These are all places inside the Assyrian Empire. And so they took the people from these places and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. So this is a relocation program. And northern Israel is now being repopulated with non-Israelis. And they took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities. Samaria here being used as a substitute for northern Israel. At the beginning of their dwelling there, they did not fear He Who Is, meaning they were not worshipers of He Who Is, the God of Israel, the Creator. Therefore, He Who Is sent lions among them, which killed some of them. Now, there is some natural explanation for lion attacks here, because when you depopulate an area, the wild animals that have kind of been kept in check by human activities start breeding more. And so wild lion populations start to grow in the areas of northern Israel, and people get attacked. But that should not take away the supernatural element that's mentioned here in 2 Kings, that God is the one that is allowing these animal attacks to take place because these people are not worshiping He Who Is. So they're being judged. So, verse 26, the king of Assyria was told. So Sargon II, in his reports from his repopulation procedures, he's told that there are people dying in the Samaritan area because of lion attacks. So the king of Assyria was told, the nations that you've carried away and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the law of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and behold, they are killing them because they don't know the law of the God of the land. Now, this, again, plays into that idea we've seen many, many times, that polytheists, those that worship many gods, are prone to believe that gods are regional, that they rule over their particular piece of land, and their power base radiates outward from their temple or their image. So the people who have just been moved into the old territory of northern Israel are saying the reason we're being attacked by these wild animals is because we don't know how to worship the local God. And so their request is, please help us. Help us learn how to worship the local God here and to appease him. Verse 27, then the king of Assyria commanded, send there one of the priests whom you carried away from there, and let him go and dwell there and teach them the law of the God of the land. And so one of the priests whom they'd carried away from Samaria came and lived in Beth-El and taught them how they should fear he who is. Now pay attention to the terminology that's used here. A priest at Beth-El during this time period is going to be a priest of the cult worshiping the golden calf god. And so that's the guy that is brought back to northern Israel to teach the non-Israelis how to worship the God of the land. So it's a reestablishment of the golden calf cult. And that golden calf cult is probably also wound up with the worship of Baal and the worship of Asherah, which no doubt would feel familiar to these relocated Gentiles out of Babylon. And so we're seeing here a reestablishment of the adulterated worship of northern Israel, but it's being done by non-Israelis. Verse number 29. But every nation still made gods of its own and put them in the shrines of the high places that the Samaritans made, every nation in the cities in which they lived. So again, we're talking about polytheists, worshipers of many gods and goddesses. And so these guys are not trying to become exclusive worshipers of the golden calf god of Beth-El. They just want to make sure that they can add that god, which they're probably calling he who is, into their pantheon, because they've still got other gods and goddesses that they're bringing from their own territories. Verse 30 starts listing them out. The men of Babylon made Sukkot Benot. It has something to do with the tents, and it's some Babylonian god that was worshipped by these gods, and so they're bringing that with them. The men of Kut made Nergal. The men of Hamath made Ashima. And the Avivites made Nibhats and Tartak. And the Severvites burned their children in the fire of Adramelech and Anamelech, the gods of the Sepharim, or Sepharvayim. Now, we don't need to go into the details of all these gods and goddesses. They're Mesopotamian gods and goddesses. Some of them have little local twists on them, and others have been imported from elsewhere in the Middle East, such as Adramelech and Anamelech. The Melech component there is the Israeli vocabulary word for king, but it was also the source word for the worship of Molech, the god of the Moabites and the Ammonites, which was worshipped by the burning of children in fire. And the Moabites and the Ammonites had this twisted worship cycle that they brought out of their history. Remember, the Moabites and the Ammonites came out of Lot after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the way that they worshipped the God that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah was by appeasing him through getting drunk and getting pregnant and then giving those human sacrifices as if they were animal sacrifices to the God of fire. And so the burning of little babies was something that came out of Moab and Ammon and now has made it all the way up into Mesopotamia. Excuse me. But they also feared he who is and appointed from among themselves all sorts of priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. So they feared he who is, but also served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away. So this is one of the components of the twisted history of the future Samaritans that will be thought of in some respects as an offshoot of the Jewish faith, but a rebellious one, is this basic paganism that is being established here during the last part of the 8th century BC. Now, it'll be tamped down and compressed into a monotheistic approach in later components, but it is still going to be twisted nonetheless. Now, the writer of 2 Kings, no doubt a prophet, says, "To this day they do according to the former manner. They do not fear he who is, and they do not follow the statutes or the rules or the law or the commandments that he who is commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. He who is made a covenant with them and commanded them, you shall not fear other gods or bow yourselves to them or serve them or sacrifice to them, but you shall fear he who is, who brought you out of the land of Egypt with great power, with an outstretched arm. You shall bow yourself to him. To him you shall sacrifice. And the statutes and the rules and the law and the commandment that he wrote to you, you shall always be careful to do. You shall not fear other gods, and you shall not forget the covenant that I've made with you. You shall not fear other gods, but you shall fear he who is your God, and he will deliver you out of the hand of your enemies." However, they would not listen, but they did according to their former manner. So the later prophet, writing down 2 Kings, summarizes this all up as just par for the course. God had warned the people of northern Israel against serving other gods and goddesses, and they ended up going into exile. These people that have been brought in, they get a chance to get a restart with the true and living God, and what do? They bring their own gods and goddesses, and then they learn from an exiled priest how to worship this twisted version of he who is. And so it's just more of the same. So these nations feared he who is and also served their carved images. Their children did likewise and their children's children as their fathers did, and they do to this day. So we got this twisted connection between God, the true God, he who is, at least his name, and the non-Israelis that have come in and repopulated northern Israel and have become kind of the beginnings of the Samaritan peoples. So that's all going on in the last quarter of the 8th century, during the time of Sargon II. And something else is happening in southern Judah. And that is recorded in 2 Kings 18, verse number 7. This is all about King Hezekiah that we've been talking about, a righteous king, a good king, a revivalist king. He who is was with him wherever he went, and he prospered. So Hezekiah doing things right. So when the Assyrians invade, Hezekiah is on the throne, and he refuses to bow to them. So he rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. So his father, Ahaz, had reached out to Tiglath-Pileser III and had paid him tribute. Hezekiah refuses to bow to Shalmaneser V, and then when he's gone, he refuses to bow to Sargon II. He will not pay them tribute. And eventually, that's going to bring the Assyrian Empire against the kingdom of Judah. But God will intervene on their behalf. But not yet. That's still a little ways off. But something else that Hezekiah did, verse 8, he struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory from watchtower to fortified city. So Hezekiah strengthens his western border with the Philistine territory and reestablishes Judean dominance over that Mediterranean coastline, or at least a significant portion of it. And that will be a hindrance somewhat to the Assyrian Empire sweeping through the area. On that very topic, let's talk about what happened when the Assyrians did try to take southern Judah into their orbit. And that is recorded in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. 2 Chronicles chapter 32. Now, there is a little bit of chronological difficulty in this area. I'm not going to get into all the weeds, all the fine points of debate about this, but Sargon II, when he came to power in 722, seems to have had to start taking care of resistance to his leadership closer to home. And so what had been the successful taking of northern Israel in 723 under Shalmaneser could not be followed up immediately by Sargon II by just marching farther south into Judah. That had to wait for a while. So it has been suggested, based on the names involved in this story, that right around 715 BC, Sargon II permitted his crown prince, the future king of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, a man by the name of Sennacherib, to try to bring the Judean kingdom into the Assyrian Empire. And that's what's being recorded here in 2 Chronicles 32. Let's go with that chronology, that we're looking at something that happened about 8 years after the northern kingdom had gone into exile. Something that happened during the 14th year of King Hezekiah, when counted from the time that he became the crown prince of southern Judah. So 2 Chronicles 32, 1. After these things, meaning the things that happened with Hezekiah, and these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came. Now, in this case, we would have one of those out-of-sequence naming of this man's ultimate office, that he's not actually king at the time this happens, but he will be king in the future. And I think that that is a reasonable understanding. So Sennacherib, king of Syria, came and invaded Judah and encamped against the fortified cities, thinking to win them for himself. Sennacherib appears to sweep around onto the western flank of southern Judah, which might have been one of the good reasons for Hezekiah establishing a good solid border on that flank. Verse 2, when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and that he intended to fight against Jerusalem, he planned with his officers and his mighty men to stop the water of the springs that were outside the city, and they helped him. Water supplies are very important for both cities under siege and for the armies that are carrying out the siege. So when Hezekiah becomes aware that the army of the Assyrians is operating in his area, and that their ultimate intention is to come to Jerusalem, he decides to make sure that the water supply for the city of Jerusalem is secured inside the walls. And the water that would typically spill outside the walls from this water supply source, we're talking about the pool of Gihon, would be stopped from going outside the walls. This is the time when what's referred to as Hezekiah's tunnel is going to be excavated or built. Verse 4, a great many people were gathered, and they stopped all the springs and the brook that flowed through the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? So previous to this time, the Gihon spring, which was actually inside the walls of ancient Jerusalem, so the southern portion of Hezekiah's city, that water supply overflowed the pool and went through little channels and through little natural cave systems and poured out into the Kidron Valley. And so that would have been a water supply source for any besieging army. So they stop up all of those places where the water overflows into the Kidron. But they need to divert that water somewhere else. And so what they do is they dig a tunnel, which is an amazing engineering feat, that will take that excess water and put it into what is called the Pool of Siloam, which is in the very southern end of the ancient city of Jerusalem, the extreme southern portion of Hezekiah's Jerusalem. And today, if you go to Israel as a tourist, you can walk through Hezekiah's tunnel because water is still flowing through it from the Gihon pool down to what remains of the Pool of Siloam. I haven't been through the Hezekiah tunnel. Maybe one of these times when I go, I'll go through that. But this happens right now that they build that particular tunnel. Now, what else does he do? Verse number 5. He set to work resolutely and built up all the wall that was broken down and raised towers upon it. And outside it, he built another wall and he strengthened the Milo in the city of David. Now, the Milo does seem to be the eastern reinforced wall of David's ancient palace. It was actually a very important place when David took it. But it's been reinforced several times since then. Hezekiah also does it again. And it's not very far from that portion of the wall of ancient Jerusalem where the Gihon pool is located. So he's basically reinforcing Jerusalem, particularly the oldest parts of Jerusalem. He also made weapons and shields in abundance, and he set combat commanders over the people and gathered them together to him in the square at the gate of the city and spoke encouragingly to them, saying, be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or dismayed before the king of Assyria or all the horde that is with him, for there are more with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is he who is our God to help us and to fight our battles. And all the people took confidence from the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. So he doesn't just simply try to depend upon his own preparations for defending the city of Jerusalem. He also reminds the people, God himself is the one that will protect us from this invader. At this point, let's jump all the way down to the end of the chapter, down to verse number 30, where it says, this same Hezekiah closed the upper outlets of the waters of Gihon and directed them to the west side of the city of David. So that's the whole Hezekiah tunnel thing. Then Isaiah supplies some of the historical information here in Isaiah 36, starting at verse number 2, and we're going to run out of time before we get too far here. Verse number 2, the king of Assyria, and we're talking here about Sennacherib, who's the crown prince, acting on behalf of his father, Sargon II. The king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh, which is a technical term for a high-ranking military officer in the Assyrian army. From Lachish, that's where the Assyrian army currently is, which is on the southwest side of Judah. It's down on the flank. So the king of Assyria, or the crown prince of Assyria, sends a military officer from where they're besieging Lachish up to Jerusalem to threaten Hezekiah into giving up. And this is where we'll have to take up the story tomorrow when we get back into the Word.